It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Dramatic changes have happened in the ocean in South Central Alaska in the last few years. What's going on? On today's show, I have two authors who studied and written on the impact of climate change on the marine environment, from increasing acidity to rising seawaters. I'll be asking them about the drivers of these changes, their impacts, and the challenge of communicating them in a way that will connect with Americans and lead to solutions. One writer, Nancy Lord, is trying to connect with readers about ocean acidification using fiction. She has a new novel about scientists studying this ocean threat and being undercut by corrupt deniers of the problem. In the second half, I'm joined by writer Jeff Goodell, who has written about these issues from a national perspective and came to Alaska with President Obama, interviewing him for Rolling Stone when he was the first president to visit Alaska's Arctic. For outdoor folks, these are critical issues because the ocean is so much a part of the way we enjoy our state. My first guest today is one of Alaska's best-known writers, Nancy Lord. She has a new novel called PH. That's right, a novel about acidity, which is a pretty unique topic for a novel. Specifically, it's about ocean acidification. And Nancy's written a number of books. She has four books of fiction behind her, including three short story collections, five nonfiction books. Fish Camp is one of her well-known books. She's written very beautifully about Alaska environment and culture and how we interact with the environment and about climate change and other environmental issues. And she's written three short story books, now this novel, and also an edited book. And she was the writer laureate of Alaska from 2008 to 2010. Thanks for being here, Nancy.
Oh, thanks, Charles, for inviting me.
Yeah, so it's unusual to write a novel about science, I mean, to put it mildly. And you've written nonfiction books about science. Why did you decide to talk about ocean acidification in a fiction setting rather than simply write another nonfiction book about this research?
Yeah, good question. My last book before this was called Early Warming, and it was about how communities and people are coping and adapting to climate change in the north. And the last part of that, I dealt with ocean issues, both warming and acidification. And that was the sort of most interesting part of the book to me. It was sort of the newer and, you know, I don't know, because I'm kind of ocean oriented. Anyway, so I wanted to do more with that. But I thought that we've all got cases of bad news fatigue, and people are, I think, like really tired of hearing bad news about the environment. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, maybe there's a way that, you know, I could maybe get more readers, or at least let readers have more fun in the form of a novel. And so I tried to write this as a comic novel. I think it has a fair amount of humor in it. And, it, you know, of course, it has, because it's fiction, it has a plot. It's got, you know, in fiction, only trouble is interesting. So there's trouble, mm-hmm. there's conflict. And I just also had wanted to work more in fiction, because fiction is
That's where you started.
Fun.
That's where
it's
you started out.
It is where I started.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. So I think that we should introduce listeners to kind of what ocean acidification is. The name of it, unfortunately, sounds very technical just to begin with. And yet, in a way, it's simpler than climate change and the sort of the global warming, because when we talk about why is CO2 warming the planet, we have to get into how does solar radiation interact with carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. In the case of ocean acidification, there's really not much room for debate about it, right? I mean, we emit all this carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and the ocean absorbs it. We can measure that.
Right. About a third of the man-made carbon dioxide that we put into the atmosphere from burning fossil fuels, et cetera, has been absorbed by the oceans. And it used to be thought of as a good thing because it was buffering the global warming by taking it out of the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. No one really thought that that it could actually change the chemistry of the ocean until relatively recently, but we've found that it has changed and is continuing to change the chemistry. So it's the seawater is becoming more acidic, and people misunderstand a little bit. It's not that it's acidic; it's becoming more acidic. So on the pH scale, it's still on the alkaline side of the scale, mm-hmm. but it's moved in that direction at a significant rate that is already having effect on those organisms that use, need the carbon to build their shells.
Right. And I guess the reason why people were not originally concerned about this and, concerned about the climate warming because of carbon dioxide goes back all the way to the 19th century and was pretty well established even the 1960s and early 70s. But it took until, as you say, within the last decade before ocean acidification really became a common topic. And maybe it's just because the ocean is so incredibly immense that it seems like you wouldn't think that something we could do by driving our cars or turning on our light switches would change the chemistry of this massive, massive thing that so much, covers 60% of the Earth's surface.
More than 60%. Yeah. It's more like it's about 3/4.
Mm.
And deep.
Yeah.
So, that was the thinking that, that it would be near impossible to change the ocean's chemistry. But in fact, we are.
It's all part of the sense that we have that the Earth is inexhaustible. When you think about people showing up, Europeans showing up in North America and thinking, well, the forests go on forever. And then a few generations later, the forests are gone. Mm-hmm. And we seem to have to relearn this lesson all over again many times, don't we?
Yeah. Well, you think of outer space, too. We put all those satellites up there, and it seems like a really big space, and now they're colliding with one another in some cases, and mm-hmm. Or just creating a lot of space junk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's talk about why it's a problem for this chemistry change to take place in the ocean. I mean, what's it hurting?
The organisms that that need to build shells, wish I could do a better job of explaining. I'm not a scientist. My various characters in the book deal with it and explain it better than I can right now.
Yeah, you seem to be able to boil it down super quickly in the book, but I guess that's because you're sitting there and thinking about it.
The carbon atoms that they need to build shells are harder for them to attain as the ocean is becoming more acidic. So they have to work harder. So I particularly feature the pteropod, which is a little marine snail, very tiny, that's a food of salmon in particular. And they are already having to sort of expend more energy to build and maintain their shells. And there's actually the cover of my book shows one, and it shows a little bit of dissolution of the shell, little pitting and so on, that's from these waters that are more acidic. But the difficult thing to understand is that different creatures respond differently to it. They're finding there's been quite a few studies now, mostly in laboratories where they can change the acidity of the water. But crabs respond differently from lobsters, from shrimp, from pteropods, from, other kinds of plankton. So it's hard to say, what's going to be hurt worse and what might possibly benefit from a little change. But the thing is that they've been living, all the sea creatures have been living in a very stable environment for a long time, and the rapid change is
stable in terms of chemistry.
Yeah. So some will be able to adapt better than others, and some will not. So we'll probably end up, losing some species and having kind of a simplified, ocean ecosystem. And one species we know that will benefit from acidification is jellyfish, which are very, very ancient and have lived in the ocean long, long time and have been very adaptable. And we're already seeing kind of proliferations of them as they sort of, prosper in waters that have been damaged by all kinds of things.
Yeah. Well, one of the key things that happens in the book, and I don't want to spoil too much, but is that where scientists come up with correlation between biological changes and chemistry changes and trying to get that word out to the world. It seems to me one of the things about the ocean related to climate change that is frustrating is that the ocean is so vast and so complex that even more on land, it's difficult to pin a culprit on any one of the things we see. So we see this huge die-off of MERS, and we want to say, well, it's because of, you know, warming in the North Pacific, and that's because of climate change. But then we really can't say that, right? I mean, the warming could have happened for some other reason, or really sort of the line of causality is not really the correct frame of reference here, right? Because the warming, you know, that you might have warm water, but it wouldn't have been as warm, or, you know, this is sort of counterfactual you have to come up with is impossible. And so that becomes one of the real frustrations and challenges in talking about this as a communicator, is we're used to talking about things like this happened because of that. But in this realm, you really can't do that a lot of the time.
That's the case with lots of things in science. There's causation and there's correlation. And so when you see, I mean, you can talk about, like, you know, big storms that we've been seeing around the world recently. They're correlated with changes in the climate, but it's hard to say that a particular storm has been caused by climate change or global warming. So you have to look at trends, and, you know, it's what gives the skeptics a lot of room to say that, you know, things are not related, but they are. It's just hard to say exactly what is causing what.
Yeah. Well, in your book, the skeptics kind of come out as villains, and they are sort of portrayed as being, sort of not honest, right? And I wonder if you feel that climate change skeptics that you've encountered are, for the most part, honest in their skepticism, or are more self-serving in denying the existence of climate change.
There's a whole industry of climate change skeptics, and they are very purposely working on behalf of those who have interests in not changing the way things are done, and I think that's well established. So they are true life villains. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there are, you know, and the word skepticism has actually been kind of corrupted too, because in science you're supposed to be skeptic. You're supposed to be sort of testing things all the time, you know, asking questions, challenging. That's all good. That's part of science. But when you have actual data that you're trying to provide misinformation or misinterpretations knowingly,
that's not skepticism.
That's not skepticism. Yeah. That's denialism,
deceit.
And deceit. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, that doesn't mean that the person you meet in the coffee shop in Homer is that way, right? I mean, how do you reach that person who's truly questioning whether this is true or not, and has heard this channel of deceitful information you're talking about? Have you had that conversation many times?
Yeah, a few times. I don't think I know how to deal with it very well, and that's why I'm a writer. I try to do it by writing. So I've tried to write a story that some of those, people who are in search of good information that they might actually read, because they could get engaged with the characters and the plot and learn something along the way. So that's how I'm dealing with it. But there's so much misinformation out there about, you know, as we know, everything, you know, all the politics of the last year have been corrupted by, you know, misinformation campaigns and false information. So there's a lot of that in our world, and it takes some careful, critical analysis on the parts of individuals to figure out what's really happening.
Yeah, it strikes me as a hopeful act for you to sit down and write a novel on this topic, when, you know, a lot of what you're talking about, this information that we're receiving, is all these little electronic snippets that are flooding over through the ether. And for someone to actually sit down and read a novel, they have to really, you know, commit to it and spend some time and, you know, not be on the computer.
Well, it's a short novel.
Right. I'm not criticizing it. I'm just saying that you're trying to break through that in a way. But it also sort of shows sort of a belief, at least, that it's possible, right, that it's going to work on some level. Well, I hope so.
I hope so. I mean, it's you know, I am a writer, so it's my form of communication. I think maybe if I were a younger person, I might, you know, pick up some different technologies to be a communicator.
I think
film and video is kind of the most effective way of communicating these days. And of course, you know, shorter things.
Yeah. I'm talking with Nancy Lord today on Outdoor Explorer. Nancy's new novel is called PH, and it's about scientists studying ocean acidification. Nancy's a writer from Homer and is author of or editor of 10 books, about half fiction and half nonfiction. She's well known for the book Fish Camp, and she's a former writer laureate for Alaska. Most of the action of the book takes place among scientists, and sort of these characters who are quite recognizable. I think if you spend any time in field science in Alaska, the main character is a sort of an older marine scientist. Have you spent much time in the field and sort of talking to scientists? Is that sort of how you picked up this world and were able to portray it?
Not a lot of time, but the first part of the book takes place on a research cruise on the Gulf of Alaska, and I did get to go on a research cruise on the Gulf of Alaska and spend a week with science people. And that
was that part of research for the book?
That was part of, yeah.
Oh, neat.
Yeah. So that was kind of the, you know, the background that that I use. But I mean, I have to say that the science people there, who were from the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, and it was mostly a lot of students from the university. They were so wonderful. They are so dedicated to their work, and were so helpful to me explaining things, and. You know, there's great integrity among that group, and there's another scientist, Jeremy Matthews, who is still associated with the University in Fairbanks, but he now is working for NOAA, who is really an expert in acidification. And for quite a few years back, he was sort of giving a lot of talks around Alaska. I probably attended 3 or 4 of his talks, and he was a great communicator and very, very, very honest and very unencumbered by any politics. He really laid it all out. So those are my kind of sources.
And your touchstones, yeah.
And I had some science people review the manuscript and check to see if I kind of had things right. But the characters that I invented for the book are entirely fictional and more flawed. In fiction, only trouble is interesting, so
right.
So they're flawed characters, and one of them is a villain, and then I also created an artist character to kind of be
comic relief
and a little bit at odds with the science, and trying to show how art and science can work together.
Although I found it, one of the very realistic elements was that the scientist who's a principal investigator who's invited her on the cruise really has no belief in the importance of bringing along an artist. He's just checking a box on a form for the National Science Foundation. that rings true.
yeah, he really doesn't get art, especially her kind of art, which was, kind of performance and conceptual art. He was looking for something that you could that could go in a museum, and that was not her. What she was doing, she was sort of she was a little woo woo art.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you know a few people like
I
that.
I do.
Maybe most of the people you know.
Yeah.
One of the sort of, I don't want to give away the story, but it becomes what's happening in the book becomes sort of a big public issue, and. I think one of my frustrations is that some of these ocean issues, which should be very important to us as Alaskans because we're an ocean state and we love fishing and we love boating and we love, kayaking. We talk about it all the time on our show. These ocean issues and these threats really are not getting that much attention. And I kind of wonder why that is. I mean, why are we unable to sort of engage with all the, there's an amazing amount of science is going on in Alaska, and some pretty alarming findings that are coming out, but you don't read about them or see them that much. Do you have a feeling for that, about why that's happening? Or maybe in Homer there is more discussion of these
items. Yeah, I think there's quite a bit of discussion among fishing communities. There's a lot of work going on at the universities, you know, here in state and elsewhere around the North Pacific. I would say our political leadership is a problem. The new people that President Trump has brought into his cabinet are lots of skeptics and a lot of abuse of science and and defunding. But on the other hand, in the state, it's been okay. The legislature actually funded a couple years some monitoring equipment specific for ocean acidification. So we've got buoys out there now. The most recently, the ferry system is now doing some monitoring because they're going there anyway along these routes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a great thing. But, as we discussed earlier, too, it's a hard subject to know how to solve. So you can do a lot of study, you can do a lot of monitoring, you can do a lot of education about it. But in terms of solving it, it's really kind of an adapting process. If you're a fisherman, you might want to diversify what you're fishing, that kind of thing. But the solution is not putting so much greenhouse gas into the atmosphere, mm-hmm. and we just pulled out of the Paris Agreement. Our country is not being responsible mm-hmm. about doing its part.
We're sort of a laggard behind it for virtually every other country in the world.
Yes.
Now.
Yeah.
Well, and as a state, and this is pointed out in the book, you know, all this great research or a lot of this great research is being funded in part by money that's coming from the oil industry and oil production through the state government to the university. And so I think there's a sense that I don't know if you feel a little bit of a sense of ambivalence among Alaskans over these issues or maybe a disconnect.
I think for sure. Alaska is so dependent on the oil industry, and people want it both ways. We want the industry, we want the money, we want the permanent fund dividend, and at the same time, I think people really do want to respond to the problem and try to be on the side of a solution, but those things are hard to do at the same time. The dependence is a real problem.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if that was one of the things that motivated you to have this theme of corruption in the book. As we were talking before, you were saying you're not pointing at the University of Alaska as being corrupt. You know, you're not alleging anything like that there. But there is this issue in the book of money sort of buying off silence or buying off science. And is there something resonant to Alaska culture in that?
I don't know that it's a issue in Alaska in particular, and I am not saying that there's any corruption at our university system, because I don't believe that. But we see it elsewhere, and we see the influence, and in lots of cases it's kind of subtle, and it has to do with campaign finances, who gets elected and then who's making decisions and nationally, and then who is afraid to speak out, who actually gets silenced, or who self-censors what they say because it will hurt them in some way. So it's kind of I simplified it in the book by having a particular villain and then kind of a system of corruption to make that point. But it is fiction in this case.
Yeah. Yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer, and I'm talking with Nancy Lord about her novel PH, and we're talking today about ocean threats, and in this half hour, about ocean acidification. Nancy, tell me about your relationship with the ocean. I know you live in Homer, and you've been a fisherman, or I'm not sure what the gender-neutral word is.
Fisherman, I think,
it works for you.
What people still prefer.
People have settled on, yeah. For a while, people were saying fisher, but that's kind of a...
That's an animal.
That's an animal, yeah.
Yeah.
How do these issues affect you personally? These ocean
issues.
Well,
yeah, I live in Homer. I think all of our coastal communities are dependent on the ocean, and I've just been. That's kind of been my. I mean, even Anchorage, although you don't face it the same way we do in other parts of the coast. But yeah, personally, I've just lived in Homer for a long time. I got commercial fished for decades. I helped found the Alaska Marine Conservation Council. I've been involved in conservation issues because I think that's important. It seems obvious to me that we ought to really care about the ocean and be really careful how we manage the resources there.
Yeah. What emotions do you feel when we see these kinds of changes we're talking about? I mean, the sort of the acidification changes, I think we're mostly talking about like larvae and plankton and sort of things that will filter up through the system. But over the last few years, we've seen stuff happening in Ketchumak Bay in the Gulf of Alaska region that's pretty dramatic and pretty sort of awful. And just to summarize some of them, obviously these temperature changes, the bird die-offs, there's a whole suite of things that have been happening. I mean, does it kind of give you a sinking feeling, or what do you think when you look at all that?
Yes. there are a lot of things happening that are of great, great concern. And the solutions aren't easy. But we should all be disturbed by these, series of events. I mean, the bird die-offs, and it was one species one year, and another species the next year. In Ketchumak Bay, we've had this whole thing with the otters.
The sea stars melting.
The sea stars melting. Right, you couldn't find a sea star in
they're gone
in Ketchumak Bay mm-hmm. This summer. I think ultimately, we're probably going to have kind of a simplified ocean system without the great diversity that we've enjoyed for so long, and it's going to be a poorer environment for all of us. So, I mean, I think that acidification eventually is going to overshadow global warming, just because so much depends on the ocean, and if the ocean really has dramatic changes in the next decades. That kind of throws everything off. So many people in the world depend on seafood.
Yeah.
It's not just us.
Yeah.
And we could have mass global starvation and just all kinds of bad results.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. It's kind of horrifying, and yet at the same time, I think that there's this issue of shifting baselines. That when the people who are being born now or showing up now look out and say, wow, there's so much here, and they don't see that there's no sea stars there, or that there's a lack of mussels, or that there are fewer birds, right? They think what's there is plentiful. When did I show up as a child, as maybe was conscious of things beginning in the 1960s, and I'm sure the elders then were aware of a much more abundant ecosystem. And so, I mean, in a way, I think it's a job of authors, and you've certainly done this in your books, to document this world that we live in, because in some ways it's going away.
Right. No, shifting baselines is a term that everyone should become mm-hmm. more familiar with, and it's a biological term that as you said, and I address it in the book very early on, where the lead scientist on this cruise is looking out and thinking about what had been there, just a few years earlier, a few years earlier than that, and something that someone had said to him about how the people in the tourist business don't want to talk about that because you don't want to, and I've had that experience mm-hmm. myself, you don't want to tell tourists that, you should have been here 10 years ago because it was, a lot better, and you want them to think that they're having, just this great wildlife experience.
It's pristine.
I have a scene where that happens and make that point.
Yeah. Well, it's challenging work, and thank you for doing it. Nancy Lord's new novel is PH, and I'm sure available in bookstores all over the place.
I hope so.
All right. thank you very much for coming in.
Yeah, thank you, Charles. Thank you very much.
And please stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and today we're talking about ocean threats. We spend so much of our outdoor time in Alaska on the ocean and on our beautiful seashores, and we know that because of ocean acidification, as we discussed in the first half, those places are changing, and sort of we're wondering what comes next. And in this half of the show, we're going to be talking about the topic of sea level rise. Because of the warming climate, the ocean is coming up on the shore. And what does that mean for the future, for really all of human civilization? But of course, we're particularly focused on our little corner of it here in Alaska. And I have an author with me who is an author of a great national repute. Jeff Goodell has written a number of books on climate and the environment. Big Coal will be known to many of our listeners. He has been in Alaska talking to the Alaska Federation of Natives. And he's kind enough to come in today to talk about his new book titled The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World, which is out from Little Brown. Thanks for being here, Jeff.
Thanks for having me, Charles.
So why did you decide to write about sea level rise? Why was that sort of the aspect that you thought was a good one to focus on right now?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I had been covering climate change for a decade or so, and I sort of knew about all the impacts of climate change, and I'd written about energy and the movement towards clean energy and how important that was. And I knew about sea level rise, but it was just like one of those things in the background to me. And then I was in New York during Hurricane Sandy, and we had about 9 feet of storm surge coming into lower Manhattan in with Sandy. And a scientist I was talking to said, you know, this is an interesting kind of dress rehearsal for sea level rise, because just imagine this storm surge coming in and not going out. And that's sort of what sea level rise will look like. And it turns out that 9 feet is sort of the high end of what we might be facing by the end of the century. So I began thinking about that, and I realized what a profound transformation this is going to be, not just obviously for places like New York, but I then went down to Miami and looked at the risks of Miami, which are even, you know, more compelling, and, you know, began thinking about coastlines around the world and realized this is a really important subject that people need to be starting to think about, and launched myself on this book.
Yeah. And a very broad-ranging book. And you went to a lot of different places, including coming to Alaska with President Obama, which we all remember. It now seems like a million years ago, actually.
It does.
No, it wasn't that long ago. And he was focusing on climate change and went to the Arctic and went to some of the communities most threatened by it. And I want to get into that. But first, I wanted to talk about something that I was a strong takeaway for me from the book, which is if you're thinking about climate change as being, well, a foot over some period of time, and that doesn't sound like so much. You know, you think, well, waves go up and down a few feet, and you stand, you know, and you sort of think of this rise as being this very gradual rise. But in fact, what we're talking about is storms that are able to come above what we're used to thinking of as the high tide line and into the uplands, into sounds and cities and whatever. And so it's not a gradual thing. It's actually a very sudden, chaotic, and crisis-oriented thing, because
right.
It happens when the storms happen.
Right. So a foot of sea level rise will have a big impact on higher storm surge. You're going to get a foot more, at least, of storm surge when you get a big storm, which means a lot more coastal erosion. And especially in sort of low, flat areas like northern Alaska and other places, but a foot of sea level rise horizontally is
huge.
It depends on the elevation and stuff, but it can be thousands of feet. So that's a big impact. But the other part of this about it being fast that's really important to grasp about sea level rise is that we know from the geologic record of the past that sea level rise doesn't necessarily happen in a sort of slow, gradual progression. There have been times in the past where there have been these big pulses of sea level rise, where a foot or more in a single decade, which is a huge amount
in a decade.
And we know that that's happened. And there's a lot of scientists right now who are very concerned about what's happening in West Antarctica and thinking that something like that is possible to happen again. And so, you know, this is not a far-off, distant problem. This is something that we could be facing. In fact, we are facing already right now. I mean, you can see the impact of sea level rise on the coasts of Alaska here. With President Obama, we flew above Kivalina and saw that, and we were in Kotzebue, and people here know the impacts of this already as well as anyone in the world.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk about how does it happen, because you mentioned ice, and I guess there's two drivers. One is just the warmer water takes up more space, right?
Right.
And then, but that would be slow and gradual. But then the other, what's the factor that would cause it to be sudden?
Well, so the really interesting thing that scientists are figuring out is, you know, ice dynamics are very complex. And up until a decade or so ago, you know, they thought that they could quantify how fast a big chunk of ice like Greenland or Antarctica would melt. It's just like, it's a big ice cube. You can do a physics and figure it out. But what they've recently understood is that, especially in West Antarctica, because the ocean is warming itself, that ocean is getting up underneath the glaciers into the between the continent and the bottom of the glaciers themselves, the ice sheets. And what they've understood is that they can quantify how fast ice can melt, but it can collapse very fast. So what you can possibly get, and what they're concerned about, especially in West Antarctica, with a place called Thwaites Glacier and Pond Island Glacier, is that a kind of dramatic collapse of these mile-high ice cliffs very fast into the ocean, which could cause sea levels to rise 1 or 2, 3 feet even. So basically, when you talk to the best scientists about this, they basically say all bets are off as to how fast this could happen. They do not know.
We really don't know. But you say the paleoclimate record shows that it's happened quickly. That
Absolutely.
Other times in Earth's history.
Yeah.
Right.
14,000 years ago, there was a moment called Meltwater Pulse 1A, where you had, you know, over 10 feet of sea level rise in a decade. I mean, in a century. So more than a foot a decade, which is a lot.
That's huge. Yeah. So we're seeing this, as you mentioned, on the ground already. It's not like it's something that is going to happen in the future. It has been happening and has been accelerating, right? I mean, it's back in the mid-20th century, it was happening very slowly. Now it's happening much faster.
Right.
And you mentioned Kivalina in northern Alaska. So these are communities that are very low and probably shouldn't have been built there in the first place, right? I think in a lot of cases, they're put there by missionaries, not by the Alaska Native folks. What did you see when you were up there?
Well, we didn't, when I was with President Obama, I was actually flew an Air Force One with him from Anchorage here up to Kotzebue. And we wanted to land in Kivalina, but for a variety of reasons, I think mostly because the runway was too short or something, we didn't get to actually land in Kivalina, but he made the plane sort of circle above it, and we looked out at it, and we landed in Kotzebue, and I spent an hour and a half with him in Kotzebue talking about climate and the risks there. And you know, he understood very well what was going on, and he was very articulate and concerned about how people will be relocated and what will happen to these tribal communities and what the role of the federal government is and should be in that. And you know, it's a very complex problem because there's a lot of people who are going to need help. It's not just about moving Kivalina. It's about Kivalina and a lot of islands in the Gulf Coast and Chesapeake Bay and, you know, many other places.
The Pacific Islands.
Islands, right. I mean, so it becomes a complicated question of who do you help and, you know, where do you start? It's like triage.
Right. And this was one of the things that I noted in the book, was talking about, you know, people are going to have to take care of themselves to some extent, and maybe the poor won't be able to. Of course, there are many poorer people outside of the United States than there are here. But we're now, with this series of hurricanes we've seen hitting Houston and then hitting Florida and hitting Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, I get the sense we're getting a preview of what this will look like, because if you are in Kivalina with a couple hundred people and you're competing against Puerto Rico with 3 million, you're probably not going to win that competition, right? So
yeah, and Puerto Rico's not doing so well either.
They're not doing very well either, right? Yeah. And, I mean, well, in Houston, the Johnson Space Center is right next to the water, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, there's all kinds of like super high value property that will be threatened, that will be dealt with way before anything in Alaska is dealt with, at least from the federal perspective.
Yep. Well, when I was here, with President Obama, after the president and I talked, I was walking along the coast in Kotzebue with Brian Deese, who was his top climate advisor at the time. And we were talking about this, and I was talking about how I had recently been in Miami and all the coastal real estate that's at risk there. And, you know, he said, I'm not really so concerned about what's going to happen in Miami Beach. They have a lot of money. They can take care of themselves. What's I'm concerned about is people here and people on the Gulf Coast, people who don't have the, you know, millions of dollars to simply just pick up their house and move it or elevate it or do all the kinds of things that we need to do to adapt. And that's one of the things that I really want to communicate with this book is for people to begin to start thinking about this, that these changes are going to come. You know, one of the things that people don't really grasp about sea level rise and what happens with the ocean is that because of the warming that's already in the ocean, even if we cut emissions to zero and everybody rides skateboards to work and sells their SUVs, we're still going to have sea level rise. It might be a little bit less than it would be if we, you know, put the pedal to the metal with fossil fuels, but it's going to happen. It's built in. And that's why the title of the book is The Water Will Come. So this is not a speculative scenario. This is a real life scenario that's going to happen. And the sooner we think about those risks and begin to plan for them, the better.
Yeah. I'm talking with Jeff Goodell, whose new book, as you just mentioned, is The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. In the cover, Jeff is... And I'm Charles Wolforth. The show is Outdoor Explorer. The cover is a little bit apocalyptic, right? It's skyscrapers with water sort of coming halfway up, and cities actually being underwater. And some of your descriptions have a little bit of that apocalyptic sound when you're talking about the way things would look as water comes into a city and areas are progressively abandoned. Seawalls crumble, in a few decades low-lying neighborhoods will be knee-deep. Wooden houses will collapse into sea of soda bottles, laundry, detergent, drugs, and plastic toothbrushes. Human bones floated out of caskets will be a common sight. Treasure hunters will kayak in using small robotic submersibles to search for coins and jewelry. Modern office buildings and condo towers will lean as the salt water corrodes the concrete foundations and eats at the structural beams. Fish will school in classrooms. Oysters will grow on submerged light poles. I love that part. I guess the question I have for you is, those who are talking about climate change are sort of accused of being hysterical or being extremists or whatever. In terms of how you communicate this issue, is that something that you think about or worry about, that how to pose this message? And I know you say in the book, if you don't believe climate change is happening, this is the wrong book for you, right?
Right, because
we're not going to get into that debate.
Right.
But in terms of how you express it, I mean, sort of the apocalyptic thing, is that what you really think is going to happen?
Well, there's no question it's going to happen. I mean, it's just a question of when. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, there's no, that scenario you just read would easily be an accurate description of Miami with 6 or 7 feet of sea level rise. I mean, it doesn't have to, we don't have to wait until we have 400 feet and, you know, it's Atlantis. I mean, a modern American city like Miami with 6 or 7 feet of sea level rise is, you know, abandoned and gone. It doesn't exist as we know it.
Right.
And
there's no amount of money to really deal with that, is there?
Not in places like Miami.
Right.
I mean, because of, for a lot of reasons, it's so low-lying. The geology doesn't allow you to build seawalls in the same way. I mean, it's, you know, so there's a certain fantastical element to that, but it's also, I mean, I'm a journalist, and it's there's no doubt in my mind, there's no doubt in any scientist's mind that that's going to happen. And it's not like when we have 7 or 8 feet of sea level rise, it's not like people are going to kind of clean up Miami before that. All the buildings are going to be gone. I mean, it's going to be a modern American city submerged.
Right.
With all that means, you know, and it's not going to be pretty. You know, there's a thing in Miami built right on the water, 2 feet, not even maybe a foot and a half above sea level right now, called Mount Trashmore, which is this giant garbage dump that's been there for 40 years. And it's going to be inundated. And when places like that get inundated, as we saw with Houston in Harvey, you know, it's ugly.
And right. So it's not, the road and all the garbage will come out again.
Yeah. So it's not going to be this sort of pretty, you know, new Venice kind of thing where you just have, you know, the bays, sparkling bay that's just a little higher and everybody lives happily on canals. I mean, we certainly will see, new kinds of cities, new kinds of living on the water. I actually think that there's great creativity and there'll be lots of wonderful things. I mean, living near and on water is really great. Everybody loves it. And I think people will figure out ways to do that. But we also have to acknowledge the other side of it, which is that this inundation of these major cities is going to happen and it's going to be not going to be pretty.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is because of the way that we invest on the shoreline. It's really not about nature because nature is used to the sea level rising. As you mentioned, there's a record. And these barrier islands would naturally move. And then when you put a line of houses on them and try to stop that movement, you're essentially holding back the sea with your hand, which is not going to work in the long run.
Right. I mean, it's basically, the sort of fossil fuel era infrastructure of highways and condos and things. I mean, for the book, I went to Lagos, Nigeria, and visited the water slums there, where you have people living in these primitive houses on stilts, basically. And, there's other places in the world where you have that in Bangkok and other places. But sea level rise isn't the problem for them. They just, build their houses a little bit higher. They're very adaptable, and there's no roads because they're all on water. And, our problem is that we have built all this stuff with the idea that it's never going to change. We think that this boundary between land and water is somehow permanent and that it's etched and will stay at this spot. And that's not true. And we're going to find that out very quickly. And the other big issue is that from an investment point of view, nobody is sort of holding the bag for the long term on this. Developers who build on the shore, they build these places, they're out of there within 5 years, they've sold it to condo owners or homeowners or businesses, they're holding it for a short amount of time. No one is thinking about, what's going to happen to this place in 15, 20, 30, 40 years? And how are we going to build a city on a shore that's going to be sustainable in a world where you have rapidly rising seas?
Well, it actually sounds like federal policy is the opposite direction, right? You talk about a guy who lived in New Orleans who thought about leaving after Katrina, but if he left, the government would give him less money than if he stayed and rebuilt his house.
Right.
And then he ends up being inundated again and saying, somebody help me. I'm losing everything.
Right. There's perverse incentives in the flood insurance program, especially to stay in places and rebuild rather than leave. So, I mean, the flood insurance program is its own, kind of nightmare. It's $25 billion in debt. Congress is fighting about how to reform it now. There's basically a huge subsidization of risk by people who live, in Kansas and Indiana and all that with coastal cities who are paying, these people who live in coastal cities are paying really reduced insurance rates. And not bearing the risk of what really they should be paying to live there. And I'm sympathetic with that because it's been that way for a long time. And all of a sudden, jacking rates up 3 or 4 times is a huge burden to these people. But on the other hand, at a certain point, the knowledge of that you're living in a risky area, that risk has to be borne in some way.
Yeah. It's interesting as we talk about this, my mind goes to what happened in coastal Alaska in the 1964 earthquake, which I wrote about in my book, The Fate of Nature, which is that on the east side of that earthquake in Prince William Sound, the land rose 30 feet, as much as 30 feet, and the sea created a new seashore. It didn't take that long. And on the west side, it sunk in areas around like Homer, went down 6 feet. And the town of Seldovia was destroyed, had to be rebuilt, moved.
Uh-huh, right.
And Homer Spit at that time had a forest on it. It was much wider, and they thought that might go away. So it's a sort of a preview of what this is like. You can't business as usual. It's not going to work.
Right. I mean, that's one of the things that was really fascinating to me in reporting this book was just realizing how dynamic coastlines really are.
Right.
I mean, beaches are temporary things. Our coastlines are just sort of temporary arrangements of rock and water and earth. And they're changing all the time. And that's how nature intended it. That's how they're supposed to work. So now you have this weird thing where you have in places like Miami and all along the east coast of the United States, these beach replenishment programs where they're, carting in millions of tons of sand, essentially building these beaches. And then nature comes along with high tides and washes it away. And as the water rises and rises, it becomes harder and harder to keep these, artificial beaches in place. And, You know, that's only going to work for a very much a sort of short time. So this sort of idea of the sort of temporalness of these coastlines is very powerful. And I think that there are ways to live like that. It's just that you have to acknowledge that and say, okay, we're living in a place that may be different, you know, in 5 years.
Well, and the Alaska Natives in the north where you visited, what traditionally were able to move and did move.
Right.
I mean, they didn't sort of invest so much in one place. But now we've got schools and sewer systems and everything built in one place. And so they can't afford to rebuild it.
Right.
I kind of wonder, though, if in the future that this will just be a cost that we bear. I mean, so what people talk about the cost of mitigating climate change and avoiding climate change, but the cost of dealing with it, adapting to it, is so much huger. I mean, did you look at sort of the money cost of moving all of these people away from the shore?
Oh, well, I mean, no one's done any kind of, any kind of analysis.
It's inconceivable, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's just so huge. But even the numbers for moving, you know, communities of a few hundred people are, you know, tens or hundreds of millions of dollars in some cases, you know. So it's very expensive, and it's clearly only going to be done in sort of emergency or in situations where you have a very, very politically leveraged, you know, politically powerful community that can kind of
command, you know, far more resources than is there.
Right.
It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about ocean threats today. We spend so much of our time enjoying the ocean, fishing and kayaking and all the other things we do here in Alaska. And unfortunately, the ocean is a victim and perhaps the greatest of climate change in terms of ocean acidification, as we heard from Nancy Lord in the first half, and in this half of the show with Jeff Goodell, author of The Water Will Come, talking about sea level rise. Just for a slightly more fun topic, you as a writer for Rolling Stone got to travel with President Obama and got to spend, I was really reading the book, I was amazed that sort of all one-on-one time, quite a bit of one-on-one time, just talking to him about these issues. And sounds like it was a fairly intimate conversation in terms of his response to it, is talking about his daughters and thinking about his granddaughters and feeling a certain amount of grief and sadness about the issue.
Yeah, that trip was really a remarkable trip, all the more remarkable in hindsight now, given kind of where we are with politics in America on this stuff today. But, you know, the president was really happy on that trip to Alaska. I mean, he was just smiling all the time, you know. We went to Exit Glacier and hiked around up there.
We take good care of our tourists.
Yeah, you know. He was just a happy man. I don't think I ever saw him without a smile when he was up here. And partly because, you know, he was out of the office, you know, and partly because I think that he felt that, you know, it was close to the end of his second term. He was really focusing on this issue of climate. He really wanted to get this Paris deal done. This was a part of that push to kind of bring awareness to that. And my conversation with him was really remarkable because, you know, I've been covering climate change for 15 years, and I have a real good sense when people know what they're talking about and when they don't about this, and when they kind of like want to pretend that they know what they're talking about. And, you know, I basically sat down in a school classroom in Kotzebue with just him and I, and nobody else in the room, and on two blue plastic chairs for an hour and a half. And, you know, they had no idea what I was going to ask. All I knew is that I was going to have an hour and a half, and we were going to talk about climate change. They didn't ask me. There was no prep of any sort. He had no clue what my questions were going to be. And I was just blown away by the sort of depth of his knowledge and accuracy of his sort of understanding of science. And I'm not an Obama groupie. I mean, I wrote very critical pieces of him, and especially in his first term when he kind of punted on a lot of this climate and energy stuff. So it was really a remarkable moment. And it was, you know, you can debate his political strategies and whether he did the right thing and whether he, you know, pushed hard enough and all of that. But after spending an hour and a half with him talking about this, there was no doubt that this was among, or if not the most important thing for him to accomplish in the remaining, you know, term of his presidency.
Yeah. Well, and you asked him about Alaskan oil and Arctic oil. And he did make some moves right at the very end to sort of stop oil development. And I'm curious as to whether you, do you blame Alaskans to some extent for the fossil fuels that are coming out of the state, that they're so much part of our economic lifeblood, and are accelerating and causing this climate change?
No, I don't blame Alaskans in any way. I mean, I do think that this sort of awareness of the cost of the dependency on this fossil fuel for the economy and for what it means for the future of Alaska is got to be much more talked about. And, you know, I think that, you know, as I wrote in the book, Alaska is sort of the poster child, both for the economic dependency on fossil fuels and on the impact. And so, you know, climate change is going to transform Alaska in profound ways very quickly, as it already is. And I mean, it's you know, I wrote about the coal industry in West Virginia, and there's a lot in common between Alaska and West Virginia in the sense of economic dependency on a fossil fuel. And the lesson from West Virginia was the sooner you diversify, the sooner you understand that this is going to come to an end.
Right.
This is not,
as you say, the water will come. It's not might
well,
come. Yeah.
Well, but also yeah. our dependency on oil is going to end.
It will end, and it already is. Yeah.
And but look what happened to look at West Virginia right now. It's like a broken state. It's in terrible economic shape because the coal industry was very good at keeping everyone barefoot and pregnant all the time. And
right.
you know, and to the degree that Alaska can diversify its economy, can think about, you know, the importance of salmon, you know, moving from a, you know, an oil economy to a salmon economy, renewable energy, all those kinds of things that are inevitable kind of in the shape of progress in the future, I think is really key.
Yeah. So you talked about the fact that a lot of sea level rise is already built into the system. It will happen. But you're not a fatalist. I mean, you also feel that we need to reduce carbon emissions, I assume.
Oh, absolutely.
And you talked in the book about a 2050 deadline. Do you feel like we're on the way? I mean, we're making some progress. At least countries like China are moving more to solar power, and they've announced an electric car fleet. You know, the Paris Accord seems to be being obeyed by countries around the world, even though President Trump has said he wants to pull out of it. Do you feel like we're doing enough? We're going far enough? What is your thought about the future?
We're not going anywhere near far enough. I'm very hopeful about many things that is going on, and I've been writing about this for 15 years, and I'm certainly encouraged by the kind of uptake in awareness about all of this and the changes that I've seen with solar power and with, you know, recent movement towards electric vehicles is really happening fast all around the world, especially in China. But whenever I'm like in one of my happy, optimistic moods that we're going to solve all this, I look at the only real measure that matters, which is the graph of the CO2 level from Mauna Loa, which is the sort of scientific standard how much CO2 is in the atmosphere, mm-hmm. which is really the only measurement that counts, and it's just a straight increase. I mean, there's no,
we haven't bent the curve at all.
No,
yeah.
And so, you know, you can look at what California does. You can be very hopeful. You can look at specific things, but when you think globally about our dependence on fossil fuels, and what we're doing with the deforestation, you know, it's very hard to be hopeful about it.
Yeah. Well, hopefully our listeners, the next generation, are going to do better. Thanks very much, Jeff Goodell, author of The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of a Civilized World. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that's all for Outdoor Explorer. I promise next week we'll be a little bit more cheerful. My name is Charles Wolforth. Our producer is Eric Bork. Our assistant producer is Hannah Durrell. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.